south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Okay, first, before we get into finishing what we were talking about in the last show, here's some Latin American news items I think you should know about, starting with Bolivia. You know, President Evo Morales' socialist paradise, financed not by manufacturing or brain power, but by oil. And now that oil is down by over 50% by its historic high just about a year and a half ago, old Evo's government there is really hurting. Because, you see, he did what all governments do. In good times, they expand like cancer. Come to think of it, in bad times, they expand like a cancer, too. Anyway, the government now can't pay for the socialistic promises he made to the public regarding health and education, etc. And of course, jobs. Yep, they always promise jobs now, don't they? Oh, they'll tell you they can create jobs, right? And they will, by inventing new ones in the public government sector, which can only really be financed by stealing more tax revenue from people working real productive jobs in the private sector. And if you've checked the international news lately, you'll see that people in Bolivia have taken to the streets in a big way. Now note that in Latin America, people are always taking to the streets about something or another. In fact, you can go to any capital city, like for example, La Paz, Bolivia, head down to the main Central Park where all the government buildings are, and you'll see people protesting all kinds of things. And on any given day, it's usually no more than 50 or 100 people mulling around with their various complaints. But it does no good. The government's non-responsive, and they really don't give a damn. That is, not until the crowds get so big and block so much traffic that the wives of the politicians and their bodyguards and entourages can't make it to the health spa, beauty parlor, or the airport for that shopping trip to Miami that day. Turns out, in Latin America anyway, the way to really get things done is to piss off a politician's wife or mistress. Talk about big crowds protesting. These days, you'll notice that in some capital cities in Latin America, tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of people are taking to the streets, as is the recent case in La Paz, Bolivia, protesting against, amongst other things, the virtual dictatorship of Evo Morales. Because, you see, in spite of his socialist promises, he's clamped down on freedom of speech, has censored the media, closed down some newspapers, thrown some journalists and opponents in jail, and, of course, raised taxes. Anyway, now that oil prices are in the dumpster, his golden goose has laid a few smelly rotten eggs. And that's why, in a very recent poll taken by Bolivia's biggest university, shows that 56% of Bolivianos completely reject Evo Morales' socialist government and his bid to run for a third presidential term. Now, the same poll showed that only 40% of Bolivianos would vote for him if he did run for a third term, and he's gonna. Now, note that in every single Latin American country, it's Chicago-style politics as usual. So, if Evo runs, no matter what, he'll win. Okay, now, more Latin news. This comes from San Salvador. You know, that tiny little Central American country of just a few million, whose number one export to the first world is that notorious gang, the Salvatruchas. Yes, those Salvatruchas are vastly overrepresented in places like L.A., Chicago, New York, and the U.S. prison system. Anyway, in recent news this week in San Salvador, according to law enforcement statistics, Salvadorian gangs in Salvador commit the vast majority of homicides. No surprise there. But here's the part you have to let sink in. 90% of the victims of these homicides are members of these gangland and criminal structures, with 90% of those crimes committed in established barrios and neighborhoods infiltrated by those gangs. That's the part that should make all the difference to expat gonna-bes and wannabes. That's why it's highly recommended when you land in any city in Latin America, big or small, to get a very detailed map of the zones and neighborhoods. Then, with the help of a taxi driver or someone at the tourist information booth at the airport or even the guy at the Hertz rental booth, you mark off all the iffy and bad areas. From then on, you just stick to the safer, better zones. And as I mentioned in past shows, Even in those Latin American cities that get terribly bad press in what might be considered war zones, based on what you may have read or seen about them in the first world media. That said, even in so-called dangerous cities like San Salvador, Guatemala City, Tegucigalpa, San Pedro Sula, Honduras, Lima, Peru, Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo, Brazil, and on and on. In fact, you can name about 20 Latin cities or more that are on the U.S. State Department's blacklist. However, if you map them out in districts and have a local person help you, you'll find half, maybe even three-quarters of the neighborhoods and zones totally fine and safe to live, work, play, and or retire. Of course, in any big city, you have to keep your eyes open and be on your guard. I mean, come on, it's hardly fair to say that you should cross Latin American cities off your list because they're dangerous when the pickpocket capital of the world is, guess where? Vatican City, Italy. Go ahead, look it up. And now, a little news out of Uruguay. People like Uruguay. I get emails about it all the time. Emails from people who've never lived there, of course. Now, as for me, I'm not a big fan of Uruguay for a lot of reasons. One, it's got four seasons, and I don't like cold. And two, the government there is like a cancer. What government isn't, huh? And about 25% of the working public has a job in government, meaning about one out of four workers is a worthless, pustulant, pinheaded parasite. And again, I mean that in the kindest way. Now, you know, I get emails all the time from people asking me what's going to happen to Latin America when the first world finally crashes and burns. You know, whether it's derivatives, war, hackers bringing on the internet, a really major terrorist incident, a solar mass ejection, another Fukushima. I mean, there are now, count them, 12 tipping points, any of which can trigger a gigantic first world collapse. So then what happens to the third world, Latin America, and those of us gringos living in it? Well, like I've said in past shows, the common middle-class and lower-middle-class people will just grow more tomatoes and hatch a few more driveway chickens. Because, you know, they're not cooking with electricity or gas. They're cutting wood. Yes, fully 50% of Latin Americans cook with firewood. And, of course, that's inefficient and nasty and contributes heavily to deforestation, but that's the way it is. So a big-time first-world collapse, well, that's not going to affect the firewood supply now, is it? Nor are the driveway chickens going to give a rip. Oh, and by the way, 80 to 90% of Latin Americans do not have air conditioning nor central heating either. So then, when the first world does hit the skids, who will take a hit in Latin America? Well, people who have jobs working in the export industry. I mean, exporting to the first world, for example. Just this week, it's all over the news down here in Latin America. You probably didn't get it. Turns out, the secondary effect of the recent big financial problems in the EU, that's Europe, have forced much of the export fishing industry in Little Uruguay to crash and burn. Now, Uruguay is a country of 3 million people. That's about half the population of the greater Chicago area, by the way. So, just in the last few weeks, 2,000 Uruguay workers in the export fish packing and shipping industry have been fired or permanently laid off. Why? Because Europe is crashing and burning, and they're no longer buying those imports. And that's what's going to happen to the exporters everywhere in Latin America. For example, tiny Uruguay now has official government unemployment figures of around 7.5%. And if you believe that, non-governmental economists on the ground there are saying that it's more like 20%. Sound familiar? As usual, the worse things get, the more governments lie. So there's two things expats, gonna-bes, and wannabes have to look out for when the next big first world economic crisis arrives. And when's that going to be exactly? Well, I left my crystal ball in the other apartment, so can't tell you right now. But many, many folks in the know that I've been talking to lately say it's going to happen within the next 2 years. All we know for sure is that it's gonna happen. That said, there are three main things that I think expats, expat wannabes, and gonna-bes should keep in mind. When that next first world collapse does come, and you're hopefully living down here in Latin America, you don't want to be dependent on the tourism industry, that's for sure, because that's the last thing people in crisis are going to do, go on vacation. Second, when you're down here in Latin America, you don't want to be depending for your livelihood on exporting things to the first world. Unless, of course, you found yourself a nice little niche and your product is recession/depression/inflation-proof. Therefore, gonna-bes and wannabes, it's a good idea to try to market to the local Latins. And finally, I don't recommend that expats, gonna-bes, and wannabes live in any big Latin American city. A city over 50 or 100,000, let's say. Why? Because you know, or at least you've heard of what can happen in big cities when the power and the water go out. What do you do then? And what do you do if you live in a high-rise or gated community and you've got no yard or garden? You have to depend on the local stores and markets, right? And even if you think you can get there, chances are, in a crisis like that, you won't be able to depend on private or public transportation. That's why I always recommend you live in a smaller town, 50,000 or under, or 10, 15, 20, even 25 miles outside of a big city, so that if chaos reigns or rules for a while in those big cities, you'll have a nice buffer and be a half an hour to an hour or so away. Even so, like I've always said, you're better off down here when the shit hits the fan. Why? Because down here, people are used to it. Things have hit the fan here in Latin America many times in the last few generations, so people can and do scale down and go into a different mode. Even in a severe crisis, they know how to survive mostly peacefully. Whereas, for example, in the United States, they've had their very short-term momentary disasters like Katrina and Mitch. But it's always been an isolated area, never has the whole United States been affected. Even Katrina only involved small parts of three or four states. And of course, people who live on the Gulf Coast know what to do and know exactly how to handle when a hurricane's on its way. They're used to it. It's happened many times, so they just switch into hurricane mode. And down here in Latin America, when there's an earthquake, when the power goes out, when there's an economic collapse and the country goes bankrupt, like, for example, Argentina does about every 10 years, the average citizen might not like it, but they know what to do. They don't panic much. They just scale down and go into the appropriate survival mode. So let me ask you listeners up there in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. What's your survival mode and when's the last time you practiced it? I'll bet never. Well, you're going to get your chance and probably pretty soon. Oh, and a couple more things if you're thinking about moving to Little Uruguay. Now, remember what I said. It's a country of about 3 million or so. But yet, they've got an armed forces, that's Army, Navy, Air Force, of 20,000 people. So you're thinking, who cares? Well, remember this. Let's take Guatemala, involved in a big-time civil war not too long ago. It's got a population of about 16 million people. Exactly 5 times the population of Uruguay. And guess what? They have an armed forces of 20,000 men, too. So there you have it. Do the numbers. Uruguay, with a fifth as many people, has the same size army. What's that all about? Who's going to attack Uruguay? Argentina? Brazil? Paraguay? In fact, has anyone ever attacked Uruguay or even threatened to? I don't think so. So why do they need to spend 5 times as much per capita on their military as Guatemala? Well, it's all about how those Latin American political dickheads promise employment. Why not? When those hayseed farm boys come to the big city looking for work, and there ain't none, there's always the army. Now, every rational person knows government cannot create real jobs and productive employment. It can only steal money via taxes from real productive workers to create makeshift jobs. So then why do you think 1 in 4 Uruguayans work for government? And in the case of Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, Peru, and Paraguay, only about 1 in 15 people work for government. It's called creeping socialism, my friends, and in fact, in a lot of countries in Latin America, it's galloping. Oh, and one more thing about Uruguay. Some say it's a very liberal and progressive socialist country, for example, with the recent legalization of marijuana there. But that's not all. In 2009, they passed a law allowing gays to serve openly in the military. And so far, it's the only Latin country that allows those two things. And here's another thing I'm sure you certainly didn't know. Every year, the U.S. government gives Uruguay a multi-million dollar package to support the Uruguay military. Why are we not surprised, huh? So you have to ask yourself, why is that, and what does the U.S. government get out of it? So there's a few things I just thought you might like to know. Oh, and here's something of interest to everyone over 50, I guess. According to the United States Social Security Department, the average wage after taxes in the U.S. is $28,000 a year, meaning half the people in the U.S. make less than $28,000. All that really means is for the average American to continue to live a first world life, he or she'll just have to move out of the States to some third world country. Like, for example, off the gringo tourist trail in Latin America, where the average yearly income is anywhere from $3,500 to maybe $6,000 a year. So no matter how you look at it, even if you're on a crappy Social Security check making 17 or 18 grand a year, you're still making at least three times the average wage in Latin America, meaning as long as you're in the 95% of Latin America that's off the gringo tourist trail, you'll be living first world all the way. Oh, and by the way, a recent Gallup poll shows now that 88% of Americans interviewed think the American dream is dead. Meanwhile, down here in Latin America, 99% of Latins interviewed say the American dream is alive and well and can be found in all its glory in my jammy. Where else, huh? Okay, about the low cost of living in Latin America, let's talk a bit about housing. That's a question I get asked all the time. People say, Johnny, look, if you really can't count on Latins to build things to first world standards, unless you're looking over their shoulder all the time, that would logically mean you'd want to build instead of buy because you're just buying someone else's problems, as they say. So then what if you do get a tremendous deal on an existing house and you find out later you got to do all kinds of heavy-duty repairs and change a lot of things because, well, like you say, Latins just aren't into the details. So then why not build from scratch and get it right? First world right. Even if, like you say, there's a bubble and when it explodes you'll be able to get a lot of these houses at 50 cents on the dollar or even less, still, people write me saying, who cares about the bubble? Why not just build? With all that cheap labor down there, you should be able to build for 50 cents or less on the dollar versus buying outright. And in doing so, get first world quality and exactly what you want. So then, why wait for the bubble to burst? Just get some land and build now. So yes, I do get questions like that all the time. And a good way to answer that question is to repeat what happened at my last Expat Wisdom Seminar in July. During one of those seminar days, I took my little group to see two model houses, very modern model houses that were for sale. And my little seminar group was duly impressed, especially at the price. Now, the smaller house, which was 1,500 square feet, was a nice little two-bedroom place on one floor. The builder had priced at $80,000. Now, the other house, a three-bedroom place with a big loft, was about 1,800 square feet, and the builder was offering that at $100,000. Again, you supply the lot anywhere in Central America, and they'd build it for that price. But I know that all you'd have to do is take a few choice photos. Locate your own architect or builder, and you could build that $80,000 house for about $50,000. And you could build that $100,000 house, the 1,800 square foot one, for around $70,000. And believe me, if you're not into the grand mansion style of living, that is, if you're like so many expats and are into simplifying and scaling down, as it should be, many older Americans might consider any of these two houses the retirement home of their dreams. Now, I know what it's like up in the States. People talk, especially in the big city markets like Chicago, New York, Houston. For 50 grand, you might be able to get the outhouse of your dreams in your preferred ghetto, but not much more. Now, admittedly, when our seminar group was going through these houses, which were brand new model homes, like I said, a few of the attendees did spot your typical Latin errors, you know, details, details. Doors not set quite right or swinging the wrong way, a flat or improperly pitched roof, which you know will inevitably invite future water problems, things like that. But you see, those are the things you and I'll pick up on right away before you build a house like that. Details you can easily correct with the builder before he even gets started. Now, admittedly, these were pristine model homes, and those kind of defects should never have existed. However, this is Latin America, and, well, that's why you have the gringo advantage and they don't. Anyway, like I said, you have to come down here and see these things for yourself. No amount of blogging or searching on the net is going to get you that kind of hands-on experience. Oh, and by the way, at the last seminar, in attendance was a professional building inspector from the States, and he was commenting and making his mental list of all those errors and defects we were seeing as we were going through Latin buildings and construction sites. In fact, we discussed how a guy like him would be in great demand down here in Latin America. All he'd have to do would be to advertise himself as a first world professional building and construction supervisor slash inspector, advertising that he would be available to review plans and finished and partially finished structures. My bet is his phone would never stop ringing because, you see, everyone knows that buildings in time have construction problems, and boy, could they use that gringo seal of approval? The gringo advantage again. Of course, he'd have to learn how to speak Spanish, but again, details, details. It works both ways. Okay, switching gears now, back to the subject we never finished in last week's show. We're talking about the ever-popular and controversial subject of mating, dating, and romance in Latin America. If you recall, in the last show, we were talking about when first-world gringo men hook up with Latin American ladies. So then, what about the opposite case? First-world gringo ladies hooking up with Latin men. Now, we've spoken about that before in past shows, and I've actually been hammered a few times in emails by certain ladies who think I just might be exaggerating about the state of machoism down here in Latin America as it pertains to first world ladies that come down in search of romance, love, and mating and dating. Well, as it happens, just a few weeks ago I went to a party where there happened to be a lot of short and long-term expats hanging around. Quite a few of them, by the way, who'd been to an expat wisdom seminar and now were living in Latin America for good. Anyway, I ran into one expat lady who came down here with her husband about 3 years ago. They were at one of my earliest expat wisdom seminars and decided to live down here in Latin America right after that. Anyway, we hadn't run into each other for almost a year and a half. And when we got to talking, she said, "Johnny, you know what? You're so right. I've been down here 3 years now, and I've gotten to know quite a few North American gringos down here now who eventually hooked up with a Latin guy, boyfriend or husband, whatever. And the fact is," she said, "Johnny, every one of these girls was cheated on by her Latin other half. No exception," she said. "Eventually, every Latin guy cheats. Nope, it doesn't matter if he's got the gringa girl of his dreams. I mean, they all dream of having a first world gringa girlfriend or wife. That is every Latin male's fantasy. But that's not all. Not only did she say that all these Latin guys have cheated on their gringa girlfriends or husbands, she also admitted, surprisingly enough, these first world gringa ladies inevitably ended up going back to these guys. Even after getting caught red-handed, they returned to these cheating guys. Now, of course, I've been down here 25 or so years, and I know a lot of Latin guys who've hooked up with first world gringa ladies, and I see how these guys have that charming Latin lover thing down to an art. And they've also got that weepy crocodile tear thing down to an art, too. It's the fallback position when they get caught, and it really works for them. I'm telling you, these guys can break into a Hollywood-style tear jag on cue. And as most first-world women will tell you, it's highly unusual to see a real man cry. It's something you just don't see much in a first-world hetero man. There's only really three times when a first-world guy will cry. One, when he's passing a kidney stone. Two, if he's kicked square in the balls, and three, at his mother's funeral. And that's just a maybe. So the fact that Latin guys can turn on the tear ducts at will, well, I can tell you, I've seen it for myself, there's nothing that impacts or softens a first world lady's heart more, even though it's 100% BS. That's why I believe first world ladies down here in Latin America who have been wronged will break their own first world rules, soften up a bit, and take that good-looking, whining faker back. Now, I know what you first-world ladies in Portland and Cleveland are thinking. A guy cheats? No way. It's over. I'm cutting him off. That's what they all say. Until they get down here and hook up with their own personal suave Antonio Banderas. A guy, by the way, who can dance infinitely better drunk than any of the guys, gay or straight, that you went out with back in the States. I mean, how else can you explain the fact that even strong, liberated first-world gringas will take these guys back after they've been caught cheating? I know, ladies. You're saying, that'll never happen to me. I'll find my Latin pretty boy and whip him into shape. I'll make the rules. Yeah, right. But remember, the biggest mistake you can make in a relationship is to think that you're the one that can change the other person. Now, if you doubt me, just take your TV remote and flick to the nearest Latin American soap opera channel and count how many times an hour a guy cries after he's been caught cheating. Then count how many times the woman takes him back. Now, don't get me wrong. When there's that kind of confrontation, the woman does not take the guy back without a fight. In the soap operas, the telenovelas anyway, she'll punch him or stab him or beat him with a frying pan, but she does take him back. Now, expat Eddie says the key to a successful relationship is the ability to enjoy a good argument. Now, note, generally in macho Latin societies, when there's an argument, the man always wins. Or at least the woman lets him think he's won, lest her persistence turn to violence on his part. And in most cases down here in Latin America, there's no legal recourse when a woman gets her butt whooped. Now, as politically incorrect as this sounds, most Latin guys will tell you, especially guys over 40, that's all part of being married, having to occasionally discipline your wife. However, up in the States, as we know, it's quite different. When a married or romantically involved couple gets into an argument, it's usually the woman that wins. Since most men, reasonable men anyway, know there comes a time in any argument that it's time to give up and let her walk away with the trophy, lest one suffer the rest of the week on the couch or in the doghouse. In fact, one expat I know, a retired psychologist, he once told me that up in the States, when there's a fight, often when it escalates, there's quite a lot of door slamming going on. And eventually, someone walks out. However, down here in Latin America, he says, it's very rare to have a door slamming slash cooling off period like that. Turns out down here, when an argument escalates, it usually ends with the guy smacking the woman around. Now, you'd think that would only happen with the undereducated lower and middle classes, but it pervades through all classes. Now, that said, a few times I've tried to bring up that subject to a first world expat gringa down here who's either married to or had been going out with Latin men. Now, I know talking about something like that could be walking into some forbidden territory. I mean, who wants to admit their other half's been smacking them around? However, I do get the feeling by their reactions that gringas occasionally get walloped too. Now remember, up in the first world, if you ask a woman that question, she'll say, "What? If a guy ever hit me, that'd be the end." However, when I've touched on that subject down here in Latin America, the way first world gringas down here admit to openly bending their own rules and standards, especially after dating Latin guys for a while, I do get the feeling that a lot of these first world ladies just grin and bear it. In fact, just recently, one good-looking gringa lady who's been down here 4 or 5 years now, she told me that first thing that most first world gringas down here realize once they start dating Latin guys is how much they're willing to lie to you. She said, for one thing, never believe a good-looking young Latin guy when he says he isn't married, doesn't have any kids, and or doesn't have a girlfriend. She says, no hot young Latin guy is unattached. Besides being married, he just might be juggling 2 or 3 other relationships on the side. It's just a big game of conquest for them, she says. That was one of the first lessons in Latin romance she learned when she first got down here. If he's young and good-looking, he'll always claim he's free and unattached. Meanwhile, guys like that have a lot of baggage they're never ever going to tell you about.
South of the border, down Mexico.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos. She was a picture in old...